Los Achmod. So as we started to discuss yesterday, there's a lot that's very complicated and fascinating about Los Achmod. That on the one hand, it clearly presents itself as a mitzvah, certainly the way it's interpreted by the Moneh HaMitzvos and by the Sugyas and the Gemara make it pretty clear that it's a mitzvah like all the other mitzvahs of Torah, which would have rules and actions and theoretical punishments, if not actual punishments, associated with it. And yet, it seems to be very machshava related. It seems to be something that is a mental process, something that would happen in one's mind. And that presents a few difficulties, difficulties that are present anytime you talk about such a thing. That on the one hand, we can't really identify when it's happening, so that certainly makes life difficult if there were to be a punishment. Again, comes out that there isn't an actual Beis Din punishment, but the discussion at least would seem to require that we could observe something happening, and if there's no observable action, it's very hard to even talk about it in such a context. Question about that?
I think the way the Chinuch explains it is that I think Jonathan said yesterday that once you actually do the action where a person doesn't want to sell it beforehand and you convince him to sell it, so it's like a simon that he...
Right, I think that's the question we have to answer. I mean, that's a possible answer to the question. What they're addressing is this fact that unless you said something like that, unless you had some end result to look at, you'd be left with a purely mental process, which is very difficult. Certainly, if you think Bezdin's going to get involved with it, it's going to be difficult to have anything function that way. In addition, so the assumption that you can control these ideas, you can control your thoughts and your feelings towards something, is a challenging assumption in general. And it's a question whether B'chala Torah Kula, whether that's the assumption that we have. And we discussed yesterday that there are certain mitzvos and maybe certain averos that seem to be emotion-directed or thought-directed. And very often, in practice, they're accompanied or associated with an action. So we gave the example of Simchas Yontif, we mentioned Harav Soloveitchik developed this idea in that context and in many other contexts, that even though the Torah tells us V'samachta b'chagecha, which sounds like it means be happy, in practice we translate that into practical terms, eat meat, drink wine, buy new clothes, etc., because you can't necessarily be instructed to control an emotion like that. So you can be told, do things that are likely to bring about the emotion. And indeed, the kiyum ha-mitzvah will come from the emotion, and the Torah will describe it with the language of the emotion to convey that that is what we're aiming for. But in practice, we're going to have some kind of action. An example we didn't mention yesterday, but we talked about the Yantiv time at the beginning of the year, is also how the Rav understood the Rambam's formulation of the mitzvah of tshuva. His focus on vidui, which led some to comment that the Rambam doesn't think there's a mitzvah of tshuva at all, there's only a mitzvah of vidui. So the Rav explained it's inconceivable that there's no mitzvah of tshuva according to the Rambam. Rather, you have to say that tshuva is essentially an internal mental state of being, and while that is certainly the end goal, and that's certainly what we want, so we can't command somebody to be a better person, so to speak, to be a changed individual. We can only command you to do something that is likely to cause that to happen. So the action that we can point to is tshuva as vidui, the idea that confessing, we can tell you to do that much, that's an action we can be mitzaveh, and therefore the hope is that we'll bring about such a change that's more internal. So these are challenges that we have when we talk about Los Achmod in general, that it seems to be complicated by that issue, that it seems to be that these are emotionally directed ideas. And there's an additional complication, which is hard to answer, and we don't really necessarily have a very satisfactory answer, is that whatever explanation you have for Los Achmod, even if you take it out of that arena, so you have Los Asava lurking right behind. And that's the formulation that you have in the Asaras HaDibros in Vayeschanan, the way it's presented in Vayeschanan. So the pasuk contains the phrase "Lo Sasave," and that is going to have the issue even more strongly. And even if you resolve the Lo Sachmod issue, Lo Sasave does seem to have these complexities. Now there is an interesting point that's discussed in the Sefer Derech Pikudecha, which I'll mention more in a minute, because one of the things he says in the context of this mitzvah is quoted a lot by other svar. The following point is not, So we'll mention this first. The Derech Pechudacha is a Chassidish Sefer. It was written by the Bnei Yisaschar. It's with Tzvi Elimelech of Dinov, who is an ancestor of the Munkacha Rebbe. The Bnei Yisaschar is a more well-known Sefer. The Derech Pechudacha talks about the mitzvah. So his presentation of Los Achmod is particularly fascinating. And that's something I'll send Jonathan a link for to print out tomorrow. It's definitely worth reading inside. He has things that he says there that are disputed, and that's something we'll come back to in a minute. But before we get to that, so he says, he has a little footnote, and he says, don't think that it's so problematic to assert a thought, because thoughts happen against your will. So how could we say that we're going to forbid somebody to have a thought? So he says, he thinks to him it's very pashut, that the way you could relate to this is that a thought that comes to you ba'ones, against your will. So clearly you're not liable for that. Clearly a person is not responsible for thoughts that pop into his head. And as we discussed yesterday, there have been psychological studies emphasizing how the more you are told not to think about something, the more likely you are to think about it. It's known as the white bear experiment, because people are told not to think about white bears, and you can imagine what resulted. So something that pops into your head, okay, so then there's nothing you can do about that. However, if you support it, if you act to encourage it, and you do something to keep it there and to make it go further, that's where you have this prohibition. So he says that's why the language, the grammar of the Torah, of lo sisaveh, instead of lo te'aveh, the double tough, is a lashon kaved, he writes. That's a way of saying that it's not just that it happens to you, but that you are actively encouraging it, you are actively facilitating it. That's where you have the problem. So that addresses a little bit just the general issue of how can we control thoughts, still maybe is a challenging arena. But again, the existence of the phrasing lo sisaveh, which some of the Rishonim, as you maybe had a chance to see, some of the Rishonim count them as two isurim, and in the Rambam it sounds like it's two isurim. He describes it as two separate steps. So that's going to make our challenge even harder, because anytime you have some kind of a way of addressing lo sachmod, if you want to claim that that's a broad Torah issue in terms of how we relate to mental isurim, then you have to account for lo sisaveh also, which gets a little bit more complicated. However, the fact that lo sachmod is treated as a mitzvah, and the sugyas, for example, the argamar, where you have an expression like v'kaka over alav de lo sachmod, all the lashonos which treat lo sachmod as a straight isur, so if you just look at those, so then you could say, all right, so the treatment of Los Achmod as a normal Isser, like all the other Isserim in the Torah, and the language of the Gemara, that it's possible to be over on it, and the fact that it's counted by everyone, so then we can associate it with a Maisa, and we could say, all right, we've dealt with our questions of Machshava and Maisa, etc. But if you look at Lo Sisaveh separately, it is more difficult, but the Gemara, our Gemara, doesn't force us to reckon with that. But in general, it's a problem. Hi.
In terms of the Rishonim that implied that the Rambam wouldn't say the Mitzvah Tshuva, because you can't necessarily force us to get to a certain mindset, the Chinuch explicitly said that you could control your mindset. The Chinuch almost always goes like the Rambam. In fact, there he even said like he was going to the Rambam. Is that anyway problematic for Soloveitchik's diuk?
I think the phrasing of Los Sisaveh itself is problematic. I don't know, not
the
that there's no...
Wise.
Yeah, no, not the grammar, just the phrase that the Rambam goes on in the next halacha in Hilchos Gzeilah to then talk about. If he just have the halacha where he talks about Los Achmod, everything would work out very nicely. But once you get into Los Sisaveh, which the Rambam talks about in the next halacha, it's a lot harder. You know, if you can look at Los Achmod in its isolation, which we have the right to do from our sugya, but if we're trying to say that we're saying it because of any general theory of how we deal with mitzvos, then Los Sisaveh does pose a challenge. It does, you know, you can answer that challenge by saying it's all sublimated into Los Achmod and it follows the rules of Los Achmod, but I don't know if the Rambam really supports that reading so much. So it's, I think that does complicate this pursuit. Once you try to extrapolate to a broader Torah theory, it does make things a little complicated. So what we also started to see is that there seems to be a machlokus as to what is the form of the Isser. So let's assume that there is some type of an action involved. So what exactly is that action? So our Gemara had the expression that, oh, people think that Inish, the assumption people have, is that if you pay for something, you're not in violation of Los Achmod. ha, silly people. That's what it sounds like if you read the Gemara that way. So you would get the impression that that's what the Gemara is saying, silly people. They don't realize that one could violate Lo Sachmod even if he does pay for the item. Now, there are some Rishonim, we mentioned yesterday, Tosfos and Sanhedrin, which says the people aren't so silly, that even though it sounds like the Gemara is telling us they make a mistake, maybe that's not true. Maybe it's not a mistake. Maybe really that's the rule. That Lo Sachmod means that you work out some way to get something without paying for it. But if you pay for it, you're not in violation of Lo Sachmod. However, most of the other Rishonim assume not that way, especially the Rambam, and probably the Ravid also. We mentioned yesterday one could possibly affiliate the Ravid with this day in Tosfos, but there probably is a difference, because it sounds like both the Rambam and the Ravid assume that you are ultimately paying for the item. What's the difference, though, between the Rambam and the Ravid? In the Rambam's case, you're pushing the guy like crazy, and ultimately he says, okay, fine, I'll sell it to you. The Ravid seems to think, it's the way the Magen Mishnah and others read the Ravid, that if the guy sells it to you, in the end of the day, he sold it to you. The fact that you hocked him a chinik, okay, but in the end of the day, he sold it to you. The Ravid, therefore, how would he understand the Isser? That let's say you take something, and then you leave the money on the table. The guy is not interested in selling it to you at all. You don't cause him a bank account difference because you are paying for it, but he doesn't want to sell it. And he doesn't agree to sell it even in the end of the day. So that's a pretty significant difference between the Ravid and the Rambam. And it gets to the question of what exactly is the nature of the Isser of Lo Sachmod. This is something we started to talk about a little bit yesterday. Reb Chaim Ozer addresses this. It's hard to find. If you look at it, you can look it up. It's in Chelek Aleph, the Tshuvas Achiezer, in Simen Chaf Aleph. It's broken up into Osius. You can find this in Os Beis. We have to look very carefully because Reb Chaim Ozer has pages and pages where he talks about the general issue of what do you consider an exemption from Malkos. And buried in the forest of long discussion about that, many simanim one after the other, he references this very subtly. But essentially, what it boils down to is as follows. As we said yesterday, you're chayav malchus for all the lavin in the Torah, except for most of them, right? Because there's many, many, many exceptions. So you start with a default rule that if you violate a losa, say, in the Torah, Yechayev Malkus. Among the exceptions, you have a lav shein bo maisa. If you have a lav that doesn't involve any physical action, so there's no Malkus for that. Another exception is a lav anitan lehishavon. That if it's possible for you to return what you took, let's say, so it's mostly related to something along the lines of gezel. If you can pay back, so then instead of getting malchus, you pay back. So which is the reason that you're not chayav malchus for Lo Sachmod? It's machlokas the Rambam the Ravid, right? So according to the Rambam, it's because there's no maisa. And according to the Ravid, no, what are you talking about? You took the item. That's a maisa. The reason you're not chayav malchus is because you could give it back. So,
who said that?
That's the Rambam of the Ravid. But what they're getting at, many explain, and you can look in the Achiezer if you can read between the lines to see this is what he's saying. It's not such easy reading. That the Ravid, essentially, is looking at this as an offense ben adam l'chavero, right? As an offense that is essentially like gzela. So normally gzela involves I take your stuff and I don't pay you for it. And here I'm still taking your stuff against your will. I'm paying you for it, so we'll have to categorize it differently. The nature of the whole offense is a little bit different. But it's on the theft spectrum. It's on the gzeila spectrum. So what categorizes it in terms of malchus? Nitan lahishavo. In the same way you can address gzeila by paying back the gzeila, you can address los achmod by giving it back to the guy. The Rambam's focus is different. Right? The Rambam doesn't seem to see it as something you're doing to that guy. He sees it as essentially rooted in your midos, in your machshava. The fact that you want the other guy's stuff so much, that's the problem. But again, as we said, you can't punish mental processes. So when he actually succeeds in getting it, that's when everything clicks into place. And that's when he becomes punishable theoretically, but not because it's a lav shein bo ma'aseh. So that's when he violates it, but there's no malchus. Ellie?
Within the right, when you can return it, does that mean that you're just switching the money back for the item? Are you, like, does the thief get to take the money back?
Presumably he does, yeah. It's a good question why he, I mean, it wouldn't seem to be, you know, fair to make the guy keep it. Because then, you know, it's kind of a reverse kefil, except there's no kefil under these circumstances. And if you really wanted to create an interesting knas structure, so you could say that it's like kefil, you have to both pay it back and you don't get to, you don't get your stuff back. But in practice, there's no such concept. Hi.
If the Isser, according to the Rambam, there was just the thought process and then just returning it.
According to the Rambam.
The Rambam was just sort of... similar, I guess. So then, what would be the value at all of returning if that wasn't the Isser? That was just our sort of notification.
So you might not have to, of course.
According to the Rambam, you wouldn't have to return.
Possibly not, yeah, because the sale, the vice is a sale.
Right, it wasn't.
Right? What happened is different, right? The whole scenario of what took place, according to the Rambam and the Ravid, is different.
Right.
According to the Rambam, the sale actually took place, and yet you committed an avera. According to the Ravid, there was no sale. You took the item and you left the money, and so you'd have to give it back. So the Rambam, as we mentioned yesterday, we have to kind of reconcile what seems like an internal contradiction, because he says you're not in violation until you actually take it, and he has this drasha, chimud sheyesh bo maisa, and then in the same breath he says there's no maisa. So that's the explanation that's essentially given, that really the avera was his desire for it, and it was proven by the fact that he acquired it. So it's only a violation once he goes that far, but that's still not the avera itself. Aaron? Part of it's explicit in the Rambam and the Ravid. The Magid Mishnah fleshes it out a little bit. You know, the two phrases the Rambam has, lav shein bo ma'aseh, and that you're not usher, you're not over until you do the ma'aseh, that's all in the Rambam. And the Ravid is saying, im lacha ma'aseh gedol mizu, that's all in the Ravid. And the Magid Mishnah fills in some of the background.
So is that the only way to explain it, that in the Ravid's case, that you left the money?
That's what it sounds like. In theory, there are those who associate it with the Tosfos and Sanhedrin. I don't think that's the most common reading, but there are those who say, oh, just like the Ravid is saying, that the only Isser is when you don't pay for it. But it's unlikely, or it's a little bit less likely, that's what the Ravid means. It's not impossible to read the Ravid that way. David, you had a...
it's kind of a close question, but like, are you...
I
doubt
it. If
you can't really punish it, then technically there's a Mises. I mean... So if you want, like, if you wanted to say that it's lashin b'maisa, there's no practical punishment. So why can't the machshava just be the be over once you're the machshavas? And if you're doing, if the Rambam said that there's like sort of a maisa involved, that you're over until you do the maisa, technically there's no punishment. So that is sort of a lav sheish b'maisa.
So it's not a close cash, that's an interesting point. What you're saying is the way we mentioned at the beginning is that if the only reason we care about defining it outside of your machshava is for reasons of punishment, if it comes out that technically there's no punishment anyway, so let's go back to not caring. Let's go back to saying that it could be violated in mental processes alone, since we're not going to punish it anyway. So it's not a klas kasha, it's a fair kasha to ask. Is that essentially what you're saying? Right? That basically that the only reason we care about this is because we need to nail it down for Beis Din, and if Beis Din's not going to do anything anyway, so let's go back to not caring.
So it's more just for like the person's like, just so he knows what he did or didn't do?
A little bit. I think that's a part of it. I think that in general, if you're talking about an actual Isser in the Torah, so then we do feel we need a Hagdara whether or not Beis Din is going to punish it, and therefore, especially when you're talking about something that's so amorphous, otherwise talking about a machshava, which it's hard to know when it transfers from something that's just an automatic thought to something that you're actually doing wrong. So we could understand why we want to know for purposes of tshuva, if for no other reason, when you violate that ister, while at the same time, Bezdin technically is not going to do anything about it. But the point is well taken. So that could seem to be a difference between the Rambam and the Ravid, that the Ravid essentially understands it as a ben adam l'chavero in the spirit of theft. It's somewhere along the theft spectrum. Not all the way there, better than outright theft, but somewhere along the spectrum. While the Rambam sees it more as a midah machshava kind of issue. The problem is, it's a little bit hard to stop there, because it's one that's still associated with a ben adam l'chavero component. In the formulation, for example, that you find in the Shulchan Aruch, if you had a chance to see that, was on yesterday's Maamar Kamos, if I remember correctly. So there, he seems to see it as it's all one continuum, and one leads to the other. Right, the Los Asave will lead to Los Achmod, Los Achmod will lead to Gzela, Gzela could lead to murder. Right, these are all real life things. You know, you read the crime pages, you know, these are all things that happen. If somebody wants something, first maybe he'll try to buy it, and if it's not gonna be accessible that way, then he's not above stealing it. If you can't steal it without killing the person, then sometimes that will happen. You know, that there's all one big continuum of how people's desire for somebody else's stuff could lead to all kinds of averus ben adam l'chavero. So essentially, it could be that that's what we're talking about, that this is a part of a process, and the Torah has forbidden various points along the spectrum because of what it leads to. So it's not necessarily that we're worried about corrupting your soul, so to speak, which obviously we're worried about in general, but it's not necessarily that that's what this averus specifically is about. But maybe it is rooted in how it ultimately could end up practically hurting other people. There is an interesting model for this, where also the Rambam comes into play. There's another issur in the Torah where you find somewhat of a dual structure, and it could have a similar relationship to Los Asav and Los Achmon. Anyone have any idea what I'm talking about? Actually, maybe I'll send you some Maamar Kamos to look at tomorrow that you can make this comparison. Appears in Parshas Kedoshim. It's a set of two related Yisurim. One more chance to guess. That's a good one too. But Lo Sikom V'lo Sitor Es Bnei Amecha. The Torah tells us that we're not allowed to take revenge, and we're also not allowed to bear a grudge, which itself a fascinating Yisur. And the way the Gemara formulates that Isser, it happens to be in a very unexpected context, has to do with denying a chesed to somebody else. If somebody denies you a chesed, so the Gemara interprets those Isserim in that context. Somebody didn't do you a favor, didn't lend you something, so you don't want to lend him something else. So the Gemara says, you refuse to lend your property to somebody who didn't lend property to you, that's an Isser of Lo Sikom. That's considered to be Nekama. What's Lo Sitor? Lo Sitor is if you say that, okay, I'll lend you my stuff because I'm not a jerk like you. You wouldn't give me what I wanted yesterday, but I'm not as bad as you. I'll lend you something. So the Gemara says that's Lo Sitor. You're bearing a grudge. And there is a machlokas aposkim. Does it mean you actually have to say it out loud, or is it enough that you're thinking this? Which again provokes the whole machshava issue. So it sounds like from the formulation of the Rambam and the Sefer HaMitzvos that really what we're worried about is taking revenge. And in Mishneh Torah, the Rambam talks about how if you allow people to take revenge, so you have the Hatfields and the McCoys, you have everyone's going to be going after each other, the Dore Doros, and it's going to lead to the collapse of society. Michael?
I don't really understand why it would matter if you said it out loud, because isn't speech still non-treatable, right?
Yeah, you wouldn't get malchus for an etira no matter what. But again, when the whole question of if we can't define it at all, if we can't see it, if we're talking about uncontrollable thoughts, speech is at least controllable. So we can tell you don't say this. But to say that you can't think it is harder. It's not impossible, but it takes a greater stretch to get to that. But the Rambam's formulation specifically sounds like that we are concerned that if we allow people to bear a grudge, that will lead to revenge. I think we've discussed in the past Rav Yosef Engel's famous essay about Siag Min HaTorah, right? That Rav Yosef Engel has this discussion in a Sefer Lekach Tov about whether you ever have an Isser in the Torah that's there really to protect another Isser in the Torah. You don't do X because we don't want you to come to do Y. So that's the function that we associate in general with Isurim Drabbanan, that we know that Chazal are there to Asiyu Siag LaTorah, to protect the Torah with extra Isurim. But the idea the Torah itself does it is not so obvious, but Rav Yosef Engel has a number of examples. So at around the same time, maybe a little bit earlier, there was an author, the Chuvah Yad Moshe, who was a descendant of the Chassam Sofer. His name is also Moshe Sofer. So he has his own list of such things, independently of Rav Yosef Engel. So there's some overlaps, there are some new ones on each list. So I think on the Yad Moshe's list, he has this example of Netira, that maybe it's a Siag Min HaTorah. The Torah doesn't want you to violate Netira because ultimately what we really care about is revenge, that society really gets messed up because people are taking revenge against each other. So if we tell you not to bear a grudge, so then that will ensure we're not going to have revenge either. So it's conceivable that we have a similar structure here. That, and it could be a couple of steps. It could be that Los Asava is playing that role for Los Achmod, and Los Achmod is playing that role for Los Sigzol, etc., etc. It could be that we have a whole continuum along these lines. Now, the general problem with calling it a straight Midos issue, what bothers me is as follows. If I say it's a Midos issue, so, why? What midah is it that bothers us? How do you define, if you want to really concretize what the midah is that the Torah is trying to prevent with lo sachma, lo sasava, what is the midah? How would you formulate it?
Lack of emunah.
Lack of emunah. Okay, so where's the emunah issue?
That you feel that God didn't give you everything you need, so you have to get it from somewhere else.
So there is definitely that aspect. But the problem is, you still have to formulate it vis-a-vis someone else. I mean, it's not just about your desires. For example, if you want to connect it to Asmech B'chelgo, something like that. So it's a little bit difficult because it is seemed to be the case that this isn't just about your wanting more in life, but that it's specifically about your wanting somebody else's things. So that's what troubles me a little bit in the formulation, that it's hard to separate it from the Ben Adam L'Chavero component. Even if you call it a Midos, even if you read the Rambam the way the Rambam is formulated here, it's hard to isolate it from it somehow interacting with another. Ali?
Doesn't it kind of become more problematic in the sum-zero economy?
So it makes it more problematic, meaning it makes the Isser more easily understood.
Yeah.
So yes, it for sure would. If you see it as the idea, they usually say zero sum, right? But the idea is that if you believe, and this gets a little bit into liberal and conservative politics and communism and capitalism, but if you believe that wealth in this world is finite and that anything one person has, the other person doesn't have, so then, okay, so then that's part of where you have class warfare and all of that, that the assumption being that, okay, I need what he has in order for me to be rich. But part of the underlying assumption, which Eli is referencing here, of capitalism and of the whole attitude of tax less and get more out of more rich people making more money, et cetera, is that wealth doesn't come at the expense of other people, but that wealth is created by wealthy people. And either through their innovation or they're otherwise producing and maximizing the resources of the world. So when somebody becomes wealthy, he doesn't become wealthy at the expense of someone else, and therefore not only he benefits, but the whole world benefits. So what Eli seems to be saying, if I'm characterizing correctly, is that if you have the initial type of philosophy that all wealth comes at the expense of someone else, so then yes, your desire seems to automatically impinge on somebody else's ability to have what they have. But just more directly within this question, so there's a question we haven't really addressed yet, and David might want to comment on this. We talked about this a little bit in the Beis Medrash yesterday. Do we assume that Lo Sachmod applies if you don't want the other guy's property, you just want something like what he has? If you see he has something, he has a nice car, and you say, I want a nice car like that. You have no desire to take it away from him, and you're not going to do anything along those lines. But now, because you see his car, you want it too. You want to keep up with the Joneses. So, I don't know if I can mention what David mentioned yesterday, you know, that there, though, that he quoted somebody as saying that Lo Sachmod is a good thing, Sachmod is a good thing, because it's what drives the economy. People want to acquire more because they want to get what they see everyone else has. So there are all kinds of hashkafic issues with that, which we can talk about separately. But just in terms of Lo Sachmod, is that what the issue is? Aaron?
It depends on the way the Menchas Chinuch, or the Sefer Chinuch talks about it, is that it's going to lead for you to, like, ask if you murder somebody.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it seems to imply that it's a Midos issue. But if it's somebody else, if it's you want an object like that, like you symbolize an iPhone and you really want one,
mm-hmm.
so that's not going to lead to those sort of issues that the Chinuch speaks about, because, I mean, there's, at least in the economy of today, there's millions of them in the world.
Correct. So I think so. That's very much at the root of this question. That's very much what it's about. Ellie?
There's also the flip side question. I think if you do the mass level sapling without the machshava of it, mm-hmm. like if you own a pawn shop or something, and so you're constantly coercing people to sell things to you, they don't really want to sell it at the price that you're gouging them for. But at the same time, you don't want the object. You just
So in theory, you could have the effect on somebody. It's hard to say that the pawn shop is gouging people because they don't seek out the customers. The customers come to them.
Okay,
but theoretically, I guess if you orchestrated things in such a way, there are enough novels like that where a person is going to orchestrate a situation where somebody has to, I guess in Count of Monte Cristo, someone will, you know, create a situation where a person is dependent on you and now they have to give you something at a lower rate. It's probably an elaborate version of it, but there you are. You're doing it specifically to hurt the person rather than to get their item. Theoretically, you could have it. In general, we'll get to that maybe in a minute or two, the whole question of Lo Sachmod and Lo Sigzol. Are they necessarily connected? Can you have one without the other in both directions? And then it's also related. But this is a very important question, which Aaron just addressed a second ago. So what if I want an item that is not the other person's? It's just I want it because I saw he has it. So what's interesting is almost everyone, la halacha, believes that that is not Lo Sachmod. Lo Sachmod is specifically directed at you want the other person's thing. So that's why I find it a little bit challenging to focus on the Midah and say it's Midos separately, because if it did mean I want what the other person has, my own thing, not that I should have his iPhone, but I want my own iPhone, so then it would be easier to formulate as a Midos issue. It would be easier to say, for example, it's the opposite of Sameach Bechelko. Parenthetically, just if I'm going to keep mentioning that, I should mention that the Rosh Yeshiva of Karen Viavner of Goldbach Zatzal understood that Sameach Bechelko doesn't mean that. It means something totally different. I'd be happy to tell you what he thinks it means, but using the more common understanding of what Sameach Bechelko is about, that you should not want more than you have, and that real Ashiras comes from being satisfied with what you have, so that doesn't necessarily involve any other person. So most assume that that's not a violation of Lo Sachmod if you want something else, if you want to drive the economy, so to speak, by being inspired to buy something that somebody else has. The exception is the Derech Pikudecha that I mentioned before. And this is the sentence that gets quoted in all the later Sfarim. So in the Sefer Derech Pikudecha, the B'nai Yisaskar, so he writes that he thinks that that is indeed the case, that if somebody sees somebody else has something and he wants it, he wants his own version, not to take the thing away from that person, that is a violation of Lo Sachmod. And again, Lunetter, Jonathan, I'll send you a link if you can make some copies to read inside. It's worth reading. It's worth reading his whole treatment of the mitzvah, because then he goes on, he has a formulation that's similar to the Merches Chinuch, the Sefer Chinuch, where he talks about the rules, and he talks about the Machshava, and he talks about the philosophy behind it. So if you read the philosophy, it's L'shitaso, what he says, based on, once he already assumes in the first part of the Sefer, the first part of the Siman, it's Lamed Ches and the Derech B'Kudecha. So he says that that is a violation of Lo Sachmod. And then he goes on to say that Lo Sachmod has to do, well, essentially, like you said, with the belief that God has given you what you need, and you don't undermine that by thinking that you need more. Not necessarily because you are in any way impinging on somebody else's property rights, but because it impinges on your belief that you have what you need. So that works out L'shitaso, because he thinks that if you want the other, the other guy has it, so then that's fine. Now, other poskim point out even more specifically that if the role of the other person here is just to inform you of the existence of something. You know, I say that I need, I wish I had a phone that could take care of all my business and that could give me my emails and that could give me all kinds of fascinating apps and the like. I wish something like that existed. And then you take out your iPhone and say, oh, it exists, great, I'll get one. So then even more so, post can write, they don't think that that's anything
maybe
to do.
Would, but according to the Mises, it still would be.
Maybe, but you see, but here it's even less so. Just take it a little step further.
Why you want to be according to him, it's only when you actually want it because he has.
Correct, right. That's why I'm saying, I'm not even sure the B'nai Sosker would say it. I say that the poskim happened to point out, especially, that you only found out it exists to serve needs that you know you already had. You feel you have a void in your life, and then somebody tells you that there's this product that will address it, so then that's for sure not going to be Lo Sachma. Maybe even according to the B'nai Sosker. But if my whole desire is because somebody else has it, so then that's going to be a Lo Sachma problem. Hi.
According to the understanding that it's Dafka that he has it, so then it would be equally Lo Sachma, then if, not that you have to get it from him, but he loses it, you'd be equally happy, you'd be equally over it.
No, I don't think anyone feels that way. I mean, that is the particular kind of achzarius. Maybe somebody feels that way, I shouldn't say nobody, but I think it's much more common that once you see what the other guy has, so that arouses a certain jealousy within you, but not a desire to have him lose it to even the playing field. Right, that would definitely be problematic. I don't think that's necessarily what, I mean, in context of life, it definitely comes up, but I don't think that's what he's saying. He's saying that, okay, you never would have cared about this, but because he has it now, you want one too. So that, again, is a unique position. The poskim in general have not seen it that way, and for the reason that Aaron articulated before, that it doesn't put that person's property at risk, necessarily. It's not necessarily the way the average person would relate to it. And therefore, it's not by definition, it doesn't become Los Ahmed by definition. So the proof that the B'nai Sosker quotes in the Derech B'Kudecha is that there is a Zohar. And that the Zohar says, and this is a whole discussion in general, that the Zohar has a comment based on the way Lo Sachmod is presented in the Aseres HaDibros, that there is an exception to Lo Sachmod. And what's the exception? If you want somebody else's Torah. And we have the idea of Kinas Sofrim Tar B'Chachma, that there is a value to the kina that people feel towards each other's success in learning, and it makes each one work harder. So therefore, the Zohar says that there is an exception, Lo Sachmo doesn't apply if you're Mekane somebody else's Torah. So says the Derech B'Kudecha, well, of course it wouldn't apply. Whoever wanted somebody else's learning in the way that they want to take the learning away from them. That sounds like a science fiction story. And it said, I want you to know Shas, so I want to know Shas at your expense, I want to take your Shas away, and I should know it. So nobody has such a feeling without the science fiction model. And the idea is, okay, you know Shas, I want to know more Shas. So if we have to tell you a drasha that that's not called Lo Sachmod, I would have said it's not Lo Sachmod anyway. There's no desire to get it from the other guy. So says the Derech B'Kudecha, you see that even if you don't want to be mechaserit from the other guy, you just want it yourself, that theoretically could have been called Lo Sachmod also, and that's why we have a special exception for Torah. Hi.
Is there anything, you know, in the Sahwa that anyone quotes in regards to the concept of one-upping someone?
So clearly, hashkafically, you would see how it plays in. Specifically, it's interesting, I haven't seen it articulated in that sense, but when it comes to the, it only really works within the Derech B'Kudecha's approach. That's probably why you don't see it so much, because since it's not really adopted l'halacha by others, it's kind of essentially quoted to disagree with. So for example, there's a tshuva about this. I was discussing with Elle the other day, a sefer about, there's an entire sefer about Los Achmod, but separate from that entire sefer, if you want a mini sefer on Los Achmod, you should get yourself the Shailos and Tshuvos Betel HaChachma. The Tshuvos Betel HaChachma is a multi-volume work of responsa by Rav Bezalel Stern, who was a Rav in Melbourne, Australia. I came there during the war, I think, and he was the brother of the Debrashina Rav, which was Be'er Moshe, Moshe Stern. So his brother was Rav Bezalel Stern. So in the Tshuvos, Betel HaChachma is a standard volume of 8 volumes of Tshuvos on everything, but he happens to have several consecutive Tshuvos about Los Achmod. And if you look in Chela Gimel, the Tshuvos Betel HaChachma, which I think should be available on Hebrew books, if not elsewhere. So in Chela Gimel, in Simen Mem Gimel, all the way till Simen Nun, he talks about various issues in Los Achmod. So if you excerpted those Tshuvos, you'd have a mini sefer about everything to do with Los Achmod. So he has a Tshuva about this Derech Pechudecha, which he disagrees with. Most of the poskim essentially disagree with that whole formulation. So if you follow the Derech Pekudecha, then I think Ellie's point is well taken, then all the more so you'd probably then go to keeping up with the Joneses and one-upping them and going to the next thing. If your whole desire is to exceed the next person, so then that would be very much in that spirit. But it seems to be that the majority of poskim, the vast majority of poskim, have seen it more that you are focused on the fact that he has it and you want it. So to see it as simply a midos issue in isolation is a little harder based on that. But not impossible. I mean, we could say that that's what kinna is about. That kinna is not just about not being besameach bechelko, but it's specifically about sameach bechelko vis-a-vis someone else. And specifically about your wanting your position to be different than his. So that actually, Ellie, could be a different form of one-upping. Not that you want to one-up him to have more, but that you want his thing, that you should have it, and he shouldn't. And that maybe that is the midah of kinna. In general, kinna is itself a whole framework. Rav Schechter has commented that the Mishnah in Pirkei Avos, it's funny, just as I was walking here, so part of a listserv that talks about the Debrei Torah, as I was coming here, I got an email about this Mishnah in Pirkei Avos. It's a Mishnah that happens to be relevant to this whole idea, right? The Mishnah says that Hakina v'hataiva v'hakavod motziim es ha'adam in olam. So what does that mean literally? It says that if a person engages in jealousy, say, or in lust, in taiva, or in honor, or in chasing after all these things, so that takes a person out of the world. So what does that mean? It sounds like it means that it leads to big problems, that the root of all types of downfalls stems from these three things: chasing after lust, chasing after honor, chasing after jealousy. All of the problems of the world can be traced back to these three cores. And therefore, motziim es ha'adam min ha'olam, min ha'olam haba, a person loses his chelek in the world, in the next world, because he sins due to these three forces. Rav Schechter commented once that you could read it with a little bit of a different focus, that it doesn't mean motziim min ha'olam haba, it means a motziim min ha'olam hazeh. That all three of these issues are issues with reality, issues that put you at odds with reality. And he discussed about how taiva and kavod are all based on misconceptions. Taiva based on how you build something up in your mind and you think something is great, and then you realize that it ultimately is not such a big deal, but you pictured it as a big deal. And kavod is all an illusion, is all based on sometimes very strange considerations of what's worth something and what isn't worth something. So kinna also, kinna is about the belief that he has what's mine. And if you believe, similar to what Jonathan was saying about Amunah, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu has decided everyone should have what they need, which is also the flip side, we spoke about this a little bit at the Chanukah Chagiga, right? The idea of the Pachim Ketanim, tying to Parshas Vayishlach, that on the one hand, that which you have, you should value what you have because you believe God gave it to you to be useful. And at the same time, you should recognize that what he didn't give you is not part of what you need. So that type of kinna is essentially a midos problem, and you could articulate it in a way that specifically relates to how it affects somebody else or how it puts you in relation to somebody else. But the B'nai Yisrael's formulation, again, which is not a widely accepted formulation, but it allows for an easier understood model. Not just to say, you don't believe you need more, you're not Semech B'chelko, that's the issue. But it's problematic because almost everyone else understands it to mean specifically you want the other person's thing and you want to take it from them. So that's that poses some challenge in terms of understanding how this iser plays out. So there is another interesting question that the Shevet HaKahasi talks about. Shevet HaKahasi is the Belzer Dayan in Eretz Yisrael. His name is Shammai Kahas Gross. He has a few tshuvas about Los Achmar also. There's also a tshuva about this in the B'tzel HaChachma that raises the following issue. It's a little bit related to something Jonathan asked me in the Beis Medrash. That, okay, so let's use the Rambam's formulation. Right, let's say somebody drives a person nuts and he sells him something. So the seller, should we say the seller is in violation of Lifnei Iver? What would you think? Right. So if the person can only violate the sister when he actually gets the, let's see, again, focusing on the Rambam separately from the Ravid, the person can only actually violate the iser when he gets the guy to sell it to him. So now is there an iser on the seller? The seller is lifnei iver lo siten nichshol. He's making it possible for this person to violate an iser. So in the context of the store, it's the context we discussed the case manager a little bit, so it's not going to come up so much because in general, anything that is omed l'mechira, if it's for sale, so you don't really have the iser of Los Achmo. The post can point out that if you try to get the seller to sell it to you for less, then that could be Los Achmo. But anything that's normally for sale, that's not subject to the Isser of Los Achmo. Again, that puts it in the context that it's about hurting this person somehow, that it's somehow impinging on the person's rights. So if he's willing to sell it to you, so then you're not going to have any room for Los Achmod or Los Isabe under those circumstances. So making a seller, getting a person to want to buy something, we talked a little bit yesterday about advertising, and advertising has many ethical issues associated with it. Rabbi Rav Aaron Levine, Zecher Tzadik Levracha, talked about this in an article in the Journal of Halacha once. There's all kinds of very tricky halachic issues in advertising. But in terms of whether it violates this iser, in terms of tempting somebody to buy something that they wouldn't otherwise want. So there are many possible hashgafic issues, but the issue of this specific iser, possibly not. But what about the circumstance where it wasn't for sale? So somebody shepherded you, and you eventually said, fine, I'll sell it to you. And you gave him the object, and he gave you the money. So then, apparently, according to the Rambam, is a violation of Los Achmo. By the way, the post can also point out that if he sells it to you because you offer him enough money that it actually becomes attractive to him to sell it to you, that's probably also not Los Achmo. That if he has something he wasn't looking to sell and he didn't want to sell, but you offered him such a high amount that he now is tempted independently, so that's probably also not Los Achmo, because now in the end he's actually happy to get that high number. If he didn't want to sell it, let's say I have my Gemara and I love my Gemara and I don't want to sell it. And if you offer me $10,000, I'll sell you the Gemara. So then fine, if you're going to offer me $10,000, it's probably not Los Achmo. But then if you're going to say, okay, now please sell it to me for less than $10,000, it probably is Los Achmo, because you're going beneath the surface where it becomes the price that I would be happy with. Okay, so let's say I violate Los Achmo. I pressure you to sell it at a price you don't really want to sell it. It's a reasonable price. You sell it because I can't take being driven crazy by you anymore, so I sell it to you. Am I in violation of Lifnei Iver? So as these posts can discuss, again, you can look in the Shuvah B'Tzel HaChachma, and a number of other posts can talk about this. So they quote the Sefer Shari Deya that has a suffix about this. So the conclusion of some of the posts is that there is no violation of Lifnei Iver. So why not? They point out as a proof, doesn't really explain why not, they point out that the Menachas Chinuch has this assumption, because the question was also raised a few minutes ago by someone of whether the sale is valid. So once it happens, do we say the sale is automatically be'isser and doesn't even count, or do we say the sale is valid? Again, the Rambam's formulation, the Ravid's formulation, there was no sale really. But in the Rambam's formulation, after the fact, is the sale good? Or do we say, no, it was a Nisr Torah in terms of the sale taking place. The whole sale was premised on a Nisr D'oraisa, so it shouldn't be good. If that's what it sounds like from the Rambam, right? So the question is why? So why shouldn't we say we have a principle, Kolman de Asra Achmana Yavid Lo Mahani, that if the Torah prohibits something, normally it means that it can't be considered a valid process, with many exceptions, but take it for now. So why don't we say, okay, this sale was premised on an Isser D'Oraisa, let's say it's negated, let's say the sale doesn't count. So the Minchas Chinuch, in addressing that question, the Minchas Chinuch says, maybe we shouldn't say that, because we'll say that when you have two parties involved in some kind of transaction, and they're both violating an Isser, so let's say the whole thing doesn't take place. But here, you have the buyer and the seller. The buyer is violating an Isser, but the seller, at the end of the day, maybe he's okay with it. In the end of the day, he did sell it. So why should we penalize him after the fact by saying that the sale is no good? He didn't do anything wrong. So they point out, you see, the Minchas Chinuch's whole premise is that he didn't do anything wrong. So some of the later poskim say, okay, you see from here that there isn't even an Isser Lifnei Iver. That's the working premise that is implicit in this Minchas Chinuch, that why punish the seller? He didn't do anything wrong. So there's no reversal of the sale. So why should it be true? Think about it for a second. If that's the case, if normally we'd say there's an Isser violated by one party, somebody else who makes it possible should be in violation. So isn't that for sure true here? The seller made it possible. So why is this distinction made according to those poskim who followed the Minchas Chinuch and the others and said there's no Lifnei Iver? I could think of probably two reasons why not.
So obviously, if you're convincing him enough that it's coming against his will and you're now over the Lusafim, maybe you didn't do anything wrong. You're only over the Lusafim if you push it so far that he has no choice in the matter.
Well, he has a choice. He always has a choice. That's the
but
thing.
It's like beyond so, where it's reasonable to expect him to...
Well, but the point is that still, ultimately, he did it because he can't take it anymore. So, okay, it's a sale, but he didn't want to make the sale in the first place. He wasn't blown over by the amount of money. That's what he said. If he just said, listen, I'll give you $1 million, we'll do this for houses sometimes. Right? People aren't looking to move, but somebody sees a house he likes, he says, makes him an offer, all of a sudden he wants to move. On the real estate website, so they have houses that are for sale, and they have a price, and they have houses that aren't for sale, they just tell you where they are, and they have this make me move price, and they say that the house that they're not looking to sell, but you make a high enough offer, they'll decide they want to move. So if that's the case, so then if you offered that much money and it was the money that convinced him, so then it's not Los Alamos. Essentially, he agreed because he can't take a chaperim anymore or all the other things that you're doing. So why should he not be in violation of Lifnei Iver? I think one reason is because essentially he's the victim here. So it just doesn't make sense to ever say the victim is a partner in his own victimization. Just because it got so far that, it's as if to say that if somebody comes to punch you, so if you don't put up a good enough defense, and he actually hits you, so now you're in violation of the Iver, you should have fought back harder. Doesn't make sense, to say that just because he got further in his Isser, and you didn't put up a bigger fight, so now you're victimized worse, and we'll call you a Lifnei Iver, just be svara, that sounds very difficult to say. So that I think is one approach to take. But there's another approach that ties in very much to what we're speaking about. In the Betzel HaChachma, he says half of it, but I think you can say it in an even more fundamental way. Lifnei Iver essentially means that you enabled the Aveira. Right? The Aveira didn't happen without you. So let's think about how we've been formulating the Rambam's view. Is that what happened in the Rambam's case? When you... In the end, the guy shepherded you so much and you sold it. So, did you enable the Aveir? What do you think, based on what we've said so far today? I think it goes back to the way the Rambam formulated, right? That whole internal contradiction of the Rambam's words. That you don't violate the Isser until you do something, and it's a lav shein bo maisa. So remember how we explained it, in the name of many, that we need the action in order to show that the machshava was there, but the machshava is really the aveir. So when the person finally throws in the towel at the end of the day and says, okay, I'll sell it to you, that's not the aveira itself. That's the proof that the Avera was there. That's the physical manifestation of the Avera.
Right, but also, because according to that, you'd say that she's very present in the world caused the guy to invert.
Okay, you mean by tempting it. Right. So maybe there's no model at all of Lifnei Iver. Even though, again, hashkafically, by the way, you know, again, there is a, we have to isolate the various issues, because hashkafically, it is clear we do have a concept of being matal kina. This is where the Ayin Hara idea comes out, that we do recommend that people take measures to not evoke jealousy in other people. So whether we call it actual Lifnei Iver, and whether we say there is no concept of Lifnei Iver by Lo Sachmot, hashkafically, there are certainly overtones here, and there are themes that come from elsewhere. Pnulachem Tzafonas, Kliyokar, as a whole discussion, that we do in general recommend that people not flaunt what they have that will evoke jealousy from other people. But technically, within the Isser of Lo Sachmot, is there a violation of Lifnei Iver that's possible at all? So you point out that you'd have to, if you're going to say before you actually do something, so that just your existing is Lifnei Iver. But if we say that the Avera happens when he actually gets it, so then is the selling an act of Lifnei Iver? So presumably not. According to the Ravid, again, the question doesn't come up. According to the Ramban, where the person agreed to sell it, so then presumably that's not where the Avera is. The Avera lives earlier. The Avera lived in everything that brought led up to that point. This is just the signature on the bottom of the page. So to say that you allowed the proof to take place, that's not enabling the Avera itself. And that's probably the most straightforward approach. In the Tshuvas Patel HaChachmis, he quotes from his father, he says a general Yesod, which is along these lines, just spelling it out a little bit more. This is, if you want to look it up, I think it's Simon Memtes, in the Patel HaChach, Bechelik Gimel Memtes, that, or none, could be none, Memtes or none, take a look, that it's not, it's the Avera took place already. And essentially what he seems to mean is along the lines of what we're saying, that if we understand within the Rambam that it was all of the efforts that brought you to this point, that's where you have the Isser actually happening. So the person who sold it after he couldn't take it anymore, he's not enabling anything. If once you get to that point, then that's when it actually happens. So really, the Avera means you hock the guy so much that he can't take it anymore, he's going to sell it to you. And we know that happens because he did sell it to you. But that didn't create the Avera, so it's not shy to say Lifnei Iver. But I also think it's a compelling svar in general to say that it doesn't make sense to say the victim is ever in violation of Lifnei Iver. You know, the only thing that you have like that is the Issa Ribis, and there it's because, maybe we'll have an opportunity to discuss a little bit next semester, Ribis is a unique kind of Issa, which is probably not about a victim and a perpetrator and has its own rules, so a person is not permitted to lend the Ribis or to borrow the Ribis. But that's really an exception. In general, we would say that the victim is not considered to be in violation of anything. And you could, again, you could say that if a person is a murder victim, so he's violating Lifnei Iver, because if he had fought harder, then the guy wouldn't have actually succeeded in killing him. It's hard to say it like that. So presumably there is such a yesod one could make that the victim is not in violation. Now again, this all goes back to the question. So is he the victim? Or is little Sachmud not geared towards him? So that's where we saw a little bit of discussion about what is the hashkaf of little Sachmud. But it's hard, just source-wise, to isolate it from the fact that somebody else is being targeted by this chinda. The Nitziv comments on Chumash, so we mentioned yesterday about the relationship of Eishes Reyacha, how that gives a little bit of an insight into the mindset that Lo Sachmod refers to, and that the person should consider other people's wives, other people's property completely off limits, doesn't even occur to them to take it. But the Nitziv also gives a comment there that the juxtaposition of Eishes Reyacha, the chalashir l'reyacha, all the property, is to make the point that just like if you want somebody else's wife, so clearly that's not accessible right now, and the only way that you could possibly end up marrying her is killing him. Obviously that's not, that's got its own problems, but assuming you're not going to kill him, assuming that we're not up to lo sirtzach yet, so then the only way you're going to make this happen is if you cause such sorrows in their marriage and you convince her to divorce him, that are you going to have to convince him to divorce her? You're going to have to really do a lot of hishtadlus there so that he divorces her, and then you can marry her. So the Nitziv suggests that that's meant to be the model for everything else as well. that if he's trying to sell it, so then it's not los achmo. But if the situation is where the person has a relationship with this item, and the only way for you to get it is to chip away at that relationship until it becomes available to you, so that's what we mean when we talk about los achmo. Again, it essentially becomes a ben adam l'chaveru focus in the second half of the luchos, rather than more of a samech v'chalko kind of idea. So, just about out of time, so I will review a little bit what we're speaking about, what we spoke about today. I have a few more points to make, which we'll fill in on Monday, and then we'll move on to another sugya. Any questions about what we said so far? Any issues? Okay, so let's quickly review what we spoke about today. So we spoke about the general challenges with Isurim that seem to talk about midos or thought processes. We talked about the different formulations in the Rishonim. It seems that there are three formulations in the Rishonim as to what the scenario of the Isser is. Tosfos and Sanhedrin, that this Gemara is not a mistake, what people say, and that you only violate if you take something without paying for it. The Rambam and the Ravid both probably assume you are paying for it, but the Rambam, the guy agrees after you chaper him like crazy, and the Ravid, the guy never agrees in the first place. You take the item and you leave the money. And that correlates to two different reasons why you have a Ptur Malkus. The Ravid seems to see it as essentially an act of gezel of a different form, and therefore the Ptur Malkus is because Nitan Lei Shavan, you should give it back. And the Rambam understands it as a machshava issue that is proven by the Maisa, and therefore the Ptur of Malkus is because of Lav She'ein Bo Maisa. And then we talked about the general question, so what is it? Is it along the gezel spectrum? And it's something that impinges on somebody else's monetary rights? Is it because it will lead to gezel, and we have a whole continuum, and maybe that's the model here? Or is it a midos issue, which requires a little bit more explanation? We talked about, in terms of the gezel spectrum, how this could also relate to the similar structure by Nekimo Natira. I'll send you tomorrow some references about that, so you can see what I mean about that. And that's a possibility. Shulchan Aruch has that formulation. One leads to another, could lead to Ritzicha in the end. And if you say that it's Machshava based, it's a little bit, on the one hand, makes sense. It's about Muna and Tzimeh Pachelko, etc. The problem is, almost everyone understands that it's focusing specifically on wanting somebody else's thing for yours. We mentioned Derek Pikudecha, who was the exception, who said that if you want something like what somebody else has, that is Los Achmod. He Ray bases it on a Zohar, that if you want somebody else's Torah, that's considered to be Los Achmod. And L'shitaso, he says there that the issue is that you don't believe you have everything you need. So we talked a little bit about different formulations of that issue of Machshava. And then we talked about some parallel questions that could emerge from here, and various ways in which the mentality of whether it's Benad Mechavero or not could play out. And then we talked a little bit about how the Eishas Reacha, the way the Netziv explains, is also the model for the Isser of Los Achmo when it comes to Mammon. And we talked about the question of whether one is in violation of Lifnei Iver if you sell the item. We saw that there were some who say that you are. The question only makes sense according to the Rambam, but there are some who say that you are in violation of Lifnei Iver, and the Netiyah of the Poskim is to say you're not in violation. And then we mentioned two Svaras L'chalik. One is that we assume that anytime you're the victim, it doesn't make sense to say that you are in violation of Lifnei Iver because you were victimized. And two is because really that's not the Avera, that's just the simon of the Avera, and the Avera was everything that led up to that, and it doesn't make sense to say you're in violation of the Iver after the fact. Okay, so we will, Okay, so we will, there. Everyone should have a wonderful day.